Hi, welcome to A Look Behind and Rewind. I'm your host, Tom Nielsen. All right, Trekkies, Star Wars fans, and other stargazers, this one's for you. Today's episode has to do with exploring the heavens. Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Big Surprise. Its 10-minute mission is to tell some old stories, have a few laughs, and maybe explore some uncharted new territory where no Wookiee has gone before. Wait a minute. Wait just a minute. I have to find my phaser. Ah, there it is, right next to the lightsaber. Now I'm all ready for all the action scenes to come. By the way, while we're talking about space, has anyone here seen that new Netflix movie, Don't Look Up, with Meryl Streep and Leonardo DiCaprio? It's supposed to be a satire, so yes, there are some funny moments in it. But there are also some very serious observations on our society as a whole and how we react to planet-wide catastrophes and other examples of impending doom. It's a good flick and I highly recommend it. But be forewarned, it has the potential to keep you on the edge of your seat. So while you're watching the comet get ready to demolish Earth, it might be a good idea to keep a bottle of the hard stuff nearby just to calm you down. Just saying. It can be an intense movie. Now, if you were a kid growing up in the 50s and 60s, it's hard to avoid all the hoopla surrounding space exploration. We had Sputniks, we had the space race to see who could land the first man on the moon, and we had movies and TV shows that constantly reminded us of the great unknown right above our heads. There's Lost in Space, My Favorite Martian, Twilight Zone, The Outer Limits, Thunderbirds, Doctor Who, and many, many more. Of course, years earlier, in the days before TV, there's also that classic science fiction story by H.G. Wells, War of the Worlds, which was brilliantly adapted to a radio play by Orson Welles. When it first aired as a Halloween story in 1938, it scared the bejesus out of a large part of the listening audience, especially those living in New Jersey, where a lot of the action took place. People were totally convinced that the Martians had landed and were about to take over the planet. I must have been a teenager when I first heard a rerun of that fantastic Orson Welles masterpiece. And I remember I was so inspired by it that I wanted to create a radio play of my own. In the back of my mind, of course, I too secretly wanted to strike panic in the hearts of my listeners. So, using my brand new reel-to-reel recorder, I came up with a 10-minute tape that copied all the groundbreaking techniques of Orson Welles' fake newscasts, making it seem like the Martians were right on the verge of landing in our own backyard. I even included make-believe musical interludes like he did, to make it even more real for my listeners. I don't know whatever happened to that tape. Somehow over the years and all the moves I've made, it eventually got lost or misplaced, and I never saw it again. But to this day, my kid brother still remembers it very well. It was his first exposure to the world of electronic fiction. And who knew that in this day and age of quote-unquote fake news, that stories like the War of the Worlds would be looked back on with such fondness and reverence? It was like the first of its kind, an historic event that proved just what gullible creatures we human beings can be.
We now return you to Carl Phillips at Grover's Mill.
Ladies and gentlemen, my aunt. Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands. I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute. Something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames.
Ah!
The whole field's caught up by the woods of barns. The gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill.
Back in those early days, of course, the attraction of interplanetary space travel was just beginning to take hold. And my old man, seeing the excitement that I had for this new field of exploration, saw a perfect opportunity to help it along. So he went out and bought me my very first telescope. By today's standards, it was a rather primitive piece of equipment, more like a toy than a tool for professional astronomers. But for me, it was perfect. Just what I needed to begin my journey to the stars. So, lugging the telescope upstairs in my hot little hands, I went up to the attic, where I found one window in the front of the house that I figured would be ideal for my stargazing station. It looked out over Grant Street, facing in a westerly direction, where we usually had some pretty spectacular sunsets, thanks to the petrochemical pollution that the local Exxon refinery put into the atmosphere almost every day. You see, friends, there is a silver lining to every cloud, even the ones created by the oil industry.
Huh?
Well, that's a tangent for another day. So there I was, in the attic, hunched over my brand new telescope, waiting for the sun to go down and the darkness to arrive, so I could begin scanning the heavens for signs of extraterrestrial life.
Hello, Earthlings.
So there I waited. And waited, and waited. Now you have to understand, the city of Linden, my hometown, was right there in the middle of the New York City metropolitan area. And you know what that means, folks. Even in those early days, in the 50s and 60s, we already had a serious problem with light pollution like you wouldn't believe. There were so many street lamps, so many neighborhoods, so many highways, so many shopping centers, that the light being cast into the sky by all these homes and businesses meant that astronomers didn't even have a fighting chance to see beyond the ever-present layer of industrial haze and perpetual daytime. So after a few hours of frustration, I eventually called it a night. I didn't give up my quest, however. Night after night, I headed up to the attic to try again. Finally, one night, I lucked out. The evening sky was actually rather clear that night. Maybe it was one of those times that the refinery had shut down for maintenance. Who knows? But for me and my telescope, it meant that I could finally see beyond a few miles away. So there I sat, scanning the darkened skies, trying to orient myself using what little I knew of major constellations that could be seen in that particular corner of the horizon. The Big Dipper, the Little Dipper, Orion's Belt. I was primed for action. I did have some naive hope that I might see some meteorite showers or comets, but given the low-power telescope that I was working with, that was not a possibility. But I persisted, nevertheless. And after a few hours or so, I was just about to give up and take the telescope down when suddenly I spotted a flash of light in one corner of the sky. I turned my instrument around to focus more clearly in that direction, closely examining the mysterious red and white blinking lights. What was I looking at? Was it an honest-to-goodness UFO? Would I be the first kid in my block to report an actual sighting of an alien invader? My heart was thumping, my pulse quickened, beads of sweat popped out of my furrowed brow. I was all set to yell downstairs, "Dad, Mom, come quick! I think I've spotted a UFO!" And then I took a closer look. As the flying object drew closer, I realized that I'd made a big mistake. It wasn't a UFO at all, but rather one of the many planes flying in and out of Newark Airport. You see, friends, our town was right in the middle of the flight path for the airport. Over the course of a typical evening, there were dozens, maybe hundreds of airlines that began their final descent over the sleepy suburb of Linden. So what I was looking at, through my little telescope, was simply one of the many, many airplanes that night, all converging on the runways of Newark Airport. What a disappointment, I tell you. Years later, I had the privilege of actually working with some real live rocket scientists. A team of astrophysicists at the Harvard Smithsonian Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I have to tell you, the equipment they were using there really put my tiny telescope to shame. So if you want to shoot for the stars, you gotta play in the big boys league and shell out for some decent, professional, NASA-grade stargazing gear. You've been listening to A Look Behind and Rewind. I'm Tom Nielsen. See you next time. All right, beam me up, Scotty.
Hi, this is Tom Nielsen. If you enjoyed this podcast, you're invited to hear more of our episodes at A Look Behind and Rewind. And feel free to share our link with friends, family, and others, as well as following us on Buzzsprout.com, Apple, Pandora, or wherever you get your podcasts.